So,
welcome to Programming Languages Tutorial today. And this time we have first warm-up round with a few questions that I've prepared for you. So let's maybe have a look at those. So the first part is to kind of have a roundup on memory consistency to just trigger your the things that we have done in past once again. And yeah, first thing is about the differences between strict consistency, sequential consistency, and weak consistency. So given an execution path for each of threads in a specific synchronization algorithm, what property does the hardware or the underlying hardware model have if only a single interleaving is possible? So we have the choice between strict consistency, sequential consistency, and weak consistency. So who is in favor of strict consistency? Well, then maybe someone who is for sequential consistency. Who is awake anyway? Ah, that tells a lot. Okay. So I guess weak consistency is also not an option for you. Well, that makes the whole thing a little bit difficult. So what's the problem with the question? Yeah.
If there's only one interleaving possible, shouldn't it be strict consistency? Because I can't think of anything better than only one interleaving possible.
So. Better in the sense that it is kind of unambiguous.
Yes.
Okay. So maybe for recording once again, the proposition was having strict consistency as the property of the model, because that is, well, being more restrictive means less variation, and thus, if there's only one interleaving possible, then that's quite restricted. And yeah, that's exactly the thing. If you have something like sequential consistency, you have a few liberties in the sense that you can have different total orders of all the events happening in your program, which is not given by strict consistency, which doesn't have this concept of logical clocks, but merely concrete timings. And if we model our system with that, then we don't have any freedom of rearranging our instructions. And weak consistency is even more relaxed. So yeah, that's for that. So
it would be strict consistency for
our first question. First one done, first one awake. Good. So, what consistency guarantee does a system with a messy cache but without store or invalid date buffers give? Once again, it's about strict consistency, sequential consistency, and weak consistency. Strict consistency, anyone? See shaking heads. Sequential consistency? So that maybe, or is that a definitive yes? And then there's weak consistency. Okay, so at that point we already have a few opposing opinions about that. So strict consistency, I think I have not seen anyone in favor of that.
So that seems to be out of the race.
Strict consistency, as soon as you start introducing caches, you can kind of already rule out that there's strict consistency involved in these cases. So sequential consistency or weak consistency? Sequential consistency was one of the topics where we had a lot of content in the lecture, and the thing was that when we introduced caches, we realized that, well, with those you can get quite different local ideas of how the value of a variable might be if you don't make sure that there is kind of a protocol involved that makes sure that you always get the most recent version of that variable into your local scratch pad or cache in that case. And that was the messy protocol. So messy is the part that restores sequential consistency to systems with caches. So the question is now, that is already quite of a strong hint for sequential consistency. Now the only questions we have to ask ourselves is whether we can have these effects where you get a rearranged execution of instructions, and that was about store and invalidate buffers. So these are the next things that play a role in whether a system is sequentially consistent or not. And here we see that there's no store or invalidate buffer, so the messy protocol by itself just can rule out that there's anything that doesn't comply to sequential consistency. So weak consistency would be the one where you can rearrange the instruction effects. For our purposes here, without store and validate buffer, the messy protocol would just make sure that we have sequential consistency. So that's that. Then let's have a look at the next one. A program reaching a state S on a weakly consistent hardware can always reach the same state S on sequentially consistent hardware. Well, maybe think a little bit about that. So, who's in favor of true? Then there's false. What's the problem here with this one?
Yeah, I think it's false, but I can't explain it.
So it's just intuitive?
Yeah.
Yeah. The question is kind of related to the first one, where you talk about how many interleavings you have. Since you have the more interleavings you have, the more different states you can reach in execution. So if you have a more restrictive system, there's less states possible to be reached. If you have a more liberal system, you can reach in some more states. And the question is now, can there be states that one of the principles reaches that the other one can't?
And yes, there's differences in the state space of both of these things. So let's have a closer look to that. Yes, the what was that? There's a more there's a weakly consistent hardware. Weakly consistent hardware is the one which is not very restrictive at all. So with that, you can have a lot more evaluations of variables that are possible during execution. So the state space is pretty large. Then there's the sequentially consistent hardware, which is more restrictive. It doesn't allow for so many reorderings of your instructions. Thus, you simply can't have all the rearrangements. Thus, not so many evaluations of your variables, which results in less states. So, if the claim is now a program reaching state S on a weakly consistent hardware, this means that every state that can possibly be reached in the least restrictive system that we have, can all of those be, or can any of those be always reached in the more restrictive concept? And, well, I think now it's pretty clear. The answer is no. Reaching a state S on weakly consistent hardware can always reach, yeah, well, given any state S reachable by.
Yeah, but on a weakly consistent hardware, you can reach any state of a
weakly consistent hardware. Program reaching a state. A weakly consistent hardware could, yes. Well, but if you ask for the details here of that question, it says a program reaching a state on weakly consistent hardware means that is the set of states that can be reached on the weakly consistent. And then there's the sequentially consistent hardware. Should be a subset of those. It's the sequentially consistent hardware. So, a program reaching a state S on weakly consistent hardware. If perchance the state that you're talking about resides here, then it can reach that state also on the sequentially consistent hardware. If it happens to be a state that's found here. So that would be the thing. Good. So.
Sorry. Is strict consistency also a subset of sequential consistency?
Yeah. Good. So let's move on to something more recent. Semaphores, locks, and monitors. So, first one. We're here in the area of providing certain algorithms. So we ask whether the algorithm that's needed for a semaphore can be implemented using all the facilities that are there for mutex. Can we do so? Can we re-implement semaphore with mutex?
The other way around.
Well, the other way around is probably pretty simple, isn't it? It would be the mutex is a very special semaphore, but given well, is it really the other way around? what is a mutex and what is a semaphore?
Mutex is a protection that just one.
So it has 0 and 1, yes. And the semaphore has kind of several, has a counter associated with each other. So the question is whether we can implement this mutual exclusion thing where you have only the states 0 and 1 if we're given such a thing that has a counter. And, well, in these cases, if we start our semaphore just with a with a value of 1, we are just only once able to enter, then we already reach the 0. So that is kind of the easy way. The mutex is kind of a specialized semaphore in that sense. You would maybe, if you would want to provide something like a safe implementation of that, that also tries to handle misuses of the protocol in the sense that you increase the counter too many times, you would maybe have to add a little bit to that. But in principle, if you just restrict yourself or the counter to be started with 1 and never go more than 1, then you should be quite fine with the semaphore. So, yeah. Please take these questions not as as questions where we have to only accept the things that we see over here, and you can ask further questions. So I'm not a big supporter of having true or false questions in exams or something like that. It's just for starting discussions here. So if there's more you need to know for answering these questions, just ask. It's kind of unfair to just give you one sentence, and there might be other preconditions around and all that. So yeah, it doesn't need to be like that. Okay, so in that sense, if you restrict it like that, you can have something which is in the expressibility the same as the mutex, so that would be true. Oh. So, a mutex is re-entrant. Always. So that's a pretty no-brainer. The monitor is exactly the mutex that is re-entrant, and mutex in principle would block if you would try to acquire it once again. So yeah. A monitor can be used as a mutex. That is once again a little bit like the first one, where you have to tinker with the things that you're given. So, can you use a monitor as a mutex? Well, considering that we have said that monitor is the mutex version, which doesn't block if you acquire it a second time, we see that there's a slight difference between these two concepts. So, if you would like to have the mutex behavior, could you manage with the functions that you get from the monitor concept? Is there a way? Well, if you just keep to the monitor alone, well, it's a little bit difficult from that point of view. But Let's take also condition variables into account. That's one of the things that we get to use inside monitors. Well, those condition variables are kind of closely related to semaphores, where you can wait for them to reach zero and have these wait and notify or wait and signal things in there. So with that, you can realize the blocking. And with that, you should be able to instrument your monitor such that you can re-implement the pure wait and signal that you need for the mutex. Just start with your condition variable in evaluation to 1. So you initialize it with 1. And perform your signal and notifies signal and waits on them. So that should be doable with that sort of thing. But with just pure monitor alone, that would probably not work. So we have kind of both things: one with if you use the condition variables, one if you don't. So it's not so clear to answer to that one, depending on what features of the monitor you assume to be there. Yeah. Next one, on deadlocks. Any deadlock-free program must acquire locks in a fixed order. Is that so? Favor of yes? And in favor of no? Oh, okay, so for no there's reactions, for yes there's none. Okay, so we have talked about this thing of fixed order in the lock acquires, when we talked about this algorithm of how to prove deadlock freedom. So if the question was the other way around, where we had when we had it in the situation that we would say any program that acquires locks in a fixed order is deadlock free, that would be the theorem from the slides. However, here it is exactly the other way around. Every deadlock-free program must acquire locks in a fixed order. And this would assume that there's no program out there that acquires programs in non-fixed order and is still deadlock-free. And that already sounds a little bit fishy, I would say. But yeah, later on we will see an example where we have a deadlock-free program which acquires locks in not a non-fixed order. So I would defer the explaining contra-example to later on. But there is examples that show that you don't have to have a fixed order in your lock acquires. So that is false. Good. So, number 5. When acquiring locks in a fixed order to ensure deadlock freedom, there is no advantage in releasing them in the opposite order. Well, that's already quite specific. And it is, of course, about what advantage actually means. So if we just consider properties of deadlock freedom, is there any advantage or any effect at all? Well, I would say no. It's just about the acquiring. If we release them, then there's just, that doesn't make any difference. Although advantage, if we take other things into account, we might as well think about things like performance, or well, if you start to unlock them in the opposite order. Yeah, that's also the question, what does opposite order actually mean? So quite intuitively, you would probably have your system in a way that you would acquire your locks in a certain order and release them kind of in the same spirit of nesting that you had before. So you would probably intuitively release the innermost lock before and then continue with the next one until you reach the outermost lock. So that would kind of block your outermost lock until you have released all of them, thus preventing any other threat that kind of competes for the same locks to actually start working once again. If you do it the other way around, you yourself don't suffer from that. You don't need your locks anymore anyway, and all you do is releasing them, so you can do so. But in that case, the other threat that would compete for the same or a subset of the locks that you held before could start working once again, because assuming that we have this global lock order, the other threat would rely on having to acquire them in the same ordering as you had them. Thus, it would be interested in the outermost, not in the in the innermost lock. So, releasing them in the non-nested way. So, well. That's why I'm not so happy about this term opposite order, because releasing them in the opposite order would be actually the one that would be the intuitive one, I would say. But yeah, in any way, if you release them in the same order as you have acquired them, with respect to this lock order, then you would give the other threat a chance to start working earlier. So that could lead to more parallelism. So that is one of these aspects. So since this thing here is so ambiguous, I simply refuse to tick any of those things. So that is just, yeah. That's just ambiguous here. But good that we talked about that. Good. So the next one. The use of which concurrency construct may lead to starvation. That is, a thread that never manages to execute the critical section to completion, giving arbitrary many choices. Well, that's a long sentence. Good. But in principle, we're talking about the synchronization algorithms from the, I think, the last and even one before lecture. That's about wait-free, lock-free, locking, and yeah, the monitor implementation here. And which of those algorithms can lead to starvation, and starvation is explained after. That means although the algorithm works as its plan, it never reaches the critical section, so it can never terminate. So we have for a choice, we have wait-free algorithm, lock-free algorithm, a lock where the blocking threads are put into a queue, or signal and urgent wait monitor. Well, I can say at least one of them may lead to starvation. Any propositions? Which one? A lock where the blocking threads are put into a queue?
Yeah, because it's blocking and not blocked.
I don't understand exactly what you mean with the difference between blocked and blocked.
I don't keep track of the threads that are blocked in order to enter the lock, or the critical section, but I keep track of the threads blocking.
Section,
and I keep a queue of them, then I can let them enter in the order they queued up.
Yeah, and I know what you mean now. That was not the notion that I was aiming for when I phrased that sentence. So I threw the blocked ones in the same category. So, but I know what you mean with that, and in that sense, I would say, yeah. Then there's no arguments giving what to do with the blocked ones, and in that case, they could starve. Yes. Unfortunately, that was not what I meant with that sentence, and that's why I so heavily dislike the multiple choice things. Yeah. So, to pay respect to your thinking, I would put it there. That was not the intention, but in that sense, that would lead to starvation, or possibly. Yeah, the one that I was actually aiming for was another one. Was just the lock-free one. This one here. That's maybe a little bit easier to see. That was the kind of algorithm that used these atomic execution things, where we had the principle that they terminate, but they may fail, and thus have to retry. And there's just no guarantee that they may ever succeed in doing it. So that was the one that I was actually going for. But yeah, with terminology, that's always a thing. That's why it's so difficult to actually have unambiguous questions there. Good. So let's have a look at the whole thing continues. Oh, that one is also not very unambiguous, but let's try it anyway. Let's consider all program points P of a program with the statement lock following directly under, and a lock set of the respective program point. Which statement is true? The program is free of deadlocks if AP is a lock and AP is included in the lock set. The program may have a deadlock if AP is a lock and AP is in the lock set. The program will deadlock if AP is a lock and AP is in the lock set. The program is free of deadlocks if AP is in the lock set. And if that implies that AP is a monitor. So AP is only allowed to be member of lock set if it is a monitor, then the program deadlock free. So, first one, the program is free of deadlocks if AP is a lock and member of the lock set. Anyone for true? I see heads shaking, and yeah, everyone is not true. If we have the lock that we try to acquire already in the lock set, then we would rely in our lock order that A is already taken, and that is already the circle that we try to circumvent. So that's for sure not free of deadlocks. Well, not we can't just say or claim that it's free of deadlocks. That's the better formulation. Next one. The program may have a deadlock if AP is a lock and AP is in the lock set. You like this one? Oh yeah, so that's most of the heads up that I've seen for the event today. Okay, yeah, and that's actually the case. So the program may have a deadlock if AP is a lock. Next one, the program will deadlock if AP is a lock. And since we already have had the one before as true, we might wonder whether the stronger claim here is also true, but it's actually not. That's what we have always been talking about. Freedom of deadlocks is kind of a one-way statement. It just it talks about freedom of deadlock, and it's kind of indications that it's for sure not. It just gives you information about whether it's clearly deadlock free, but the condition that the lock is in the lock set does not say for sure that the program will deadlock, but it just may have a deadlock, so that one's also false. Next one, the program is free of deadlocks if the only acquires that we find on locks that are already in lock set are talking about actual monitors. Well, that already sounds a little bit better than before. Is that true? Is that false? Who's in favor of that? Monitors were the special things which we could not really talk too much about there, because there's this assumption of that you can reacquire them if you already have them, so you can't disambiguate between situations where you already have that lock or whether you are some concurrent threat and try to enter the monitor. So yeah, monitors are a little bit of a bummer here, but yeah, I think that you can't say that the program is free of deadlocks if the lock in question is a monitor. So, next one. A program was shown to be deadlock-free using the lock order argument. This approach to dealing with deadlocks is called deadlock detection, prevention, avoidance, or ignoring deadlock. Well, I think that's easier to answer now. detection. You say that's detection?
Yeah.
For detection, we would probably need to clarify a little bit what we mean with detection. Of course, it's somehow trying to detect things, but without really really executing the programs for that. The if you think back to the deadlock topic in the lecture, we had this concept of detecting deadlocks in the sense that we detect them as they happen. So yeah, with that notion, we will probably take back that thing. Deadlock prevention, in the sense that if you try to detect them while they haven't happened yet, and try to refuse these algorithms that can end up in deadlocks, then deadlock prevention is probably the thing that you're doing with proving that your program is deadlock-free. Deadlock avoidance, by that is these special ideas of trying to block, but that's also a runtime thing, so that is also not by doing proofs beforehand, and well, clearly it's not ignoring deadlocks, so that's that. So, an example. Consider program P, whose sole synchronization between its two threads is given by the following two program fragments. So, we have one algorithm doing acquires of A, B, and C, or at least potentially. There's a little bit of uncertainty involved with the random number generator. And it signals C, B, and A. Then we have the other thread that acquires B, C, and D and releases B, C, and D. So the question is, P may deadlock. There exists a lock order between the locks. True? Anyone? No? So, consider this one as false. The question would now be why. Yeah. Maybe let's talk about the next one to clarify a little bit. P may deadlock. There exists no lock order between the locks. Okay, let's look at the next one. P cannot deadlock. There exists a lock order between the locks. And P cannot deadlock. There exists no lock order between the locks. Okay, so now we know that in order to answer that, we should maybe first of all determine whether there is a lock order or not. Is there a lock order in the program? For that, we would need to create the lock sets. So let's maybe do so. So right at the start, lock set is empty. Then after wait, we have the lock set A. After B, we have the lock set AB. After C, we have the lock set ABC. So, first of all, we have introduced a lock set with just A. That didn't create any ordering. Then we have created the... we have added the lock B. With that, we have created the lock order AE. Then we have introduced lock C to the lock set which means that we have introduced a lock order between C and all the others, like that. And the signals, well, they just make the sets smaller until they reach the empty set once again. Then the second one, this one creates the lock set B out of nothing, so there's no lock order elements involved. Then after weight C, it creates B and C with the lock order B and C. And here it adds D, so with B, C, D in the lock set, creating another order element like that. And we can just create a global lock order from that, which is just A, B, C, D. So there is a lock order. These are the questions with no lock order. The answers with no lock order. Now the question is whether the program deadlocks or not. If there exists a lock order, then deadlock should not be possible. We can't reach any surplus on that, so that one was also not true and cannot deadlock. It's free of deadlocks by the theorem, and that's it. Okay. Good. So, I think it's the last ones, isn't it?
Yeah.
By recording an interleaving of a program at runtime, you observe the following. A thread that holds a lock is descheduled, and another thread is scheduled that then executes holding the same lock. Okay, now we can answer either this behavior should never happen since it violates the mutual exclusion property, so there must be an error in the program. The lock must be a signal in urgent wait monitor, or the lock must be a signal in continuum monitor. So, getting descheduled while having had a lock and observing another thread being rescheduled and then immediately having the same lock. Is that something that should happen or should not happen? Well, we have talked about this concept of monitors, where it was in the concept that you temporarily give away the locks and let someone else work while you wait on something, and someone else can have your locks in that time, and then when this one either terminates or notifies you, then you get the chance to work with that lock once again. If that lock is not a monitor, then that's completely fine. So, in principle, of course, that should not happen, but especially for the monitors, we have established that that would be a desirable behavior. So, that's not it. The lock must be a signal and urgent wait monitor, or the lock must be a signal and continuum monitor. Well, in order to release, well, or in order to get descheduled and have another one scheduled that holds the same lock. If you think that that you want to have such a such a thing without the signaling or notifying thread exiting the monitor in between, then I would say an urgent wait monitor would be quite fine with that. The thread that performs the signal goes immediately to sleep, so that that is releasing the monitor for the other one that waits. This one can continue immediately or urgently. So that is for sure a situation where we can observe the flowing the described behavior. Lock must be a signal and continue monitor. In these situations, you would give up the lock in between. So observing the signaling thread with being descheduled, with still having the lock, would not lead to another thread being able to be scheduled, having the same lock once again. Instead, you would have to give up the lock by leaving the monitor before the other waiting thread could work once again. So in that respect, signal and continue would not have that behavior. Good. So, final question. Completely different area now, once again. The enter operation of a monitor is called notify in Java. What about that? Is that true? Well, yeah.
Well, with notify, you tell other threads that they can now work on the resource, and with enter, you start working on it. So, seems different.
Enter is, you're entering the monitor with that. So that is not about handling the condition variables, which would be the notify. So these different concepts there. And notify is just that specialized signaling that's in the monitors, and that's in many cases also called notify in the literature, so it's direct one-to-one correspondence. So that's more of a note. Good. Now, finally, we can leave these things behind and talk about some concrete algorithms once again. We have deadlocks. Consider the following four functions. Then there's given a few functions. FG, U, and V. While F and G are both, all of them are acquiring locks and releasing locks. F acquires A and calls U while holding the lock. G acquires also the same lock A, but calls V while holding the lock and only then releasing it. And so those are quite similar. Then there's U and V, where U acquires locks B and C nested in each other. So it acquires first B and then C. Then we have V, which acquires C and B in a nested version. so much just for an overview on that. Additionally, we are giving a main function, and in order not to have to do all these pthread create things and all that, we just use this very abbreviated version of talking about parallel execution, which would be that one. So that would mean that we establish threads and let F and G run in parallel. Can this possibly cause a deadlock? Executing F and G in parallel. Yes?
I think yes. Because when G run in parallel, then it can start in parallel V and U. So it is possible that V is holding a deadlock, a lock on C, and U is holding a lock on B. And so they're both waiting for the other locks.
Deadlock found in that situation. You don't like, you like?
I thought I do it really, really, but F has to acquire A before starting U. So G also has to acquire A. So I think that they cannot start U and V in parallel.
Okay, that's right.
So just to sum up for recording once again. First we thought that we would find deadlock, because there's U and V possibly running in parallel, and U trying to acquire B, and V trying to acquire C, which would, in principle, work out fine. But now, U would try to acquire C, which is already held by V, while V tries to acquire B, which might already be held by U. And that was the first idea of, well, a deadlock happening. But then we discovered that there is this lock A, which needs to be acquired before we get into the situations of U and V running. And that is kind of the protective log. So acquiring this would give you mutual exclusive access to C and B, B, and as long as these are the only accesses to the locks, then they are protected by the lock A, and thus you can acquire them in any order that you want. So we would say that that is deadlock free. Good. So if we say that this is no deadlock, let's try to prove that with the freedom of deadlock theorem, which means that we have to set up a system of sets, lock sets, for each of the locations in the program. And if you get asked to do that, you can do it in a way that I do it here, by just annotating the programs with the lock sets. However, if that gets too messy, please refrain from smearing too much ink into that, because that will make it very hard to read, and also very difficult to get the appropriate grade for that. And in these cases, please refer to the line numbers and put for each of the line numbers the set somewhere else, in the sense that you would do something like, the lock set for 2 would be like this. This just makes it more easy to correct in case that is something that you get asked to do. So, anyway, we can do it now in the informal way, because that's a lot of program points here. So we start up from main, and in main there's just no lock set or no locks taken. So we assume that we can start just with the empty lock set for program point 2. Then after execution of this one here, we have the lock set A. There's no lock order elements created. Then we call U. So here we already start with a lock set of A. We create we acquire another lock, so we get A and B for the lock set, as well as this thing for our global lock order. We immediately acquire another lock, so we get C into the lock set. Then we release. Release a lock. Oh, no. Release the lock, and thus only A afterwards. Then we release that lock and have the empty set over here. Good. So let's do the same thing for the G, the ones in parallel. So there's no locks held over there with empty set. Then we acquire the first one, which is A, and we enter V with A in the lock set. We acquire the next lock, so we have A and C in the lock set. So A goes to C, is added over here. Then we acquire B. So we get ABC in the lock set, and put it like that. Release B, release C, and release A. So the only thing is now that we have to establish a global lock ordering, so we have to join those two. And realize that, of course, A is the least of those locks, but now we just don't know what to do with C and B. There's no global common ordering that we can give there. So that was our indicator for that we cannot establish a global lock order, thus we cannot say that the whole thing is deadlock free. All the same, with the argumentation that we had before, we have seen that that program definitely does not have a deadlock. So that is once again the counter example for that we were looking for very early on when we talked about whether having no global lock order automatically means that we have a deadlock or not. So much for that. Assuming that there's no possible deadlock, how can we change the main function in a simple way to render a deadlock possible? What do we have to change? What does it say? The main function. In a simple way to render a deadlock possible. So what do we have to change here to create a deadlock? Yes?
Instead of
having
G call U and B,
sorry, I didn't get it acoustically.
Instead of F and G call U and B.
So you would propose to do U and V in parallel. Yes, that would for sure create the deadlock. You could even
use one of the other ones, F and G, maybe. It would suffice to just not take the protecting lock in either of the branches. But yeah, with that you would immediately create the deadlock.
Yes. So finally, we change the main function so that it runs F and G sequentially. So there's no parallelism happening at all.
Obviously, as there's no parallelism involved, there can't be any deadlock, at least if we don't try to recursively acquire the same lock. We're supposed to prove this using the freedom of deadlock theorem once again. However, with that kind of calls, we will end up with exactly the same lock sets as we had before. We're starting without any locks being taken, and we would result with exactly the same situation here. So even if there's no parallelism whatsoever in there, the freedom of deadlock theorem doesn't help us here. So that just serves to make you more aware of how weak this freedom of deadlock theorem actually is in terms of certifying deadlock-free programs as actually being deadlock-free. But yeah, that's all we got here. Fine. With that, I think we're done for today.